And certainly as our organizations, our businesses, our governments, our civilization has become more and more dependent on this corpus of open source projects that arose kind of organically through this method, mm-hmm. That won't work forever to just kind of like take it on faith and hope for the best that it's all going to meet the standards that we need it to meet, that all of these individual constituent projects, each of which is important to so many downstream use cases, is going to get the level of ongoing, you know, maintenance and support and so on. And so I think building businesses around open source is essential.
And hit the music.
Is everybody in? Cool. All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. This is Grizz Griswold. Hope you're doing well. Today I have a guest who is the CEO of Tidelift. I had a lot of fun with Donald Fisher, who is the CEO and co-founder of Tidelift. We talked about a lot of things. First of all, we talked about his journey, how he came to start Tidelift, and why. And I think it's pretty interesting, especially when you consider some of the things that have been going on in the past couple of years in open source as far as paying maintainers. I don't know if you ever thought about that before, but it's pretty important, and that's something that Tidelift works on. So we go through the reasons why you'd want to pay maintainers. We talk about open source and finance, of course, and it was just an enjoyable conversation. And it was the first interview with somebody who was not Finos of the Year. So thank you, Donald, for joining us. Now we will see Donald and his crew from Tidelift in London for OSFF 2024 in June, and also in New York in September and October. And with that, it's a great segue to talk about some of our sponsors from OSFF real quickly. And so we'd like to introduce the Open Source and Finance Forum London leader sponsors, and they are FinOps and Hedera. So FinOps first. The FinOps Foundation offers professionals opportunities to grow their careers in with networking, best practices, education, and standards within FinOps and also within cloud operations. So you can find them at finops.org. We will have some of the FinOps people on site. They're great people. I got to hang out with some of them in California earlier this year. And at the conference in June, there will be a couple of talks on FinOps itself, the practice of it. I know that there's a breakout talk, and I believe that there's a keynote as well. So again, looking forward to having them there. Our next leader sponsor is Hedera. Hedera joined just before OSFF New York this past year. And it was kind of great because there was a board member, Andrew Aiken, that was with one company and had to move companies. And when he ended up at Hedera, he still wanted to be part of the FinOps community, which we thought was great. And then Andrew won a board seat as well on the board. And Andrew's just been around open source forever. Great person, great human, and also part of Hedera. So, and I should say that Hedera is an open source leaderless POS network driven by worldwide community and overseen by a diverse council of top industry players. You can find out more about Hedera at Hedera.com. You can find out about the Hashgraph and Swirled Labs as well, that is interwoven with Hedera. So check them out. We will probably have Andrew on the podcast in the next month or so leading up to OSFF. And then finally, we want to make sure that we acknowledge and do a shout out to our digital sponsor, G Research. And G Research is gresearch.com, and G Research is a British quantitative finance research technology firm, and the firm uses makes use of machine learning, big data, and other technologies to predict movements in the financial markets. So thank you again to all of our sponsors. The sponsor pipeline is still growing early before OSFF. So the last thing I'd like to say is I'm recording this on April 10th. And on April 11th, so in the morning, at 7 a.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. British Summer Time, we will be launching the London OSFF schedule. So again, by the time this goes out, and in fact, if I can put this podcast out tonight and you're listening to it, then you actually have first access to the schedule, which we've already published. And of course, there'll be a link in the show notes and on the website. So with that, I'm going to shut up and I'm going to let Donald Fisher, the CEO of TideLift, do a lot of talking. Thanks so much and catch you on the other side. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are. This is Grizz Griswold of Finos. Hope you're doing well. Today, my guest is Donald Fisher. Donald is the CEO and co-founder of TideLift. Donald, say hello.
Howdy.
I did not expect a howdy from somebody from Boston. So can you explain that, please?
I think we're a national, international presence. So I got y'alls, I got howdy, and I got pock in the car.
Pock in the car up in Bahaba. Yeah. I told you, I spent some time in New Hampshire. So every once in a while, it'll come creep back into me. So, okay. Donald, we're going to get into who you are, what you do. We're going to get into some about TideLift. We'll get into open source and finance, and we'll talk about, you know, looking future facing as well. But I do want to, you know, I want to start with you. Who's Donald? Let's talk about your journey to get to where you are now. So, you know, the dreaded question, tell us about yourself.
All good. Happy to do it. Love to talk about myself. Starting point is, you know, when you're on the airplane and you fill out the boarding landing card and it says profession there. So for profession, I write programmer. That's my nice. Profession. And that's how I started in the tech industry. And it's still a passion of mine. And so I started building in the late 90s, through the first internet bubble, et cetera. And one of the things I got really interested in very early in my journey in tech was what at the time was free software, the free software movement and the community around that. This sort of predated modern open source and sort of what that has become. And I just got fascinated by, you know, both the availability of it, what it allowed me to do as a student and early in my career in terms of having access to stuff that I wouldn't be able to get my hands on. It was like hard to get a Solaris system in those days, but it was easy for me to run Linux on my laptop. And then I started, as I went deeper and deeper into that rabbit hole, I started getting fascinated about like, how is this possible? Like where is this coming from? Who are these people? I mean, somebody's making all this open source software. How is that happening? What are their incentives? And this is awesome. So how can we amp it up and make this even better? And that's basically been my sole focus for my last two decades of my career, is figuring out how to amplify that organic energy in creative communities of smart and energized people around technology, and specifically free software and open source communities.
So you did not decide to study open source as a thing initially. I think a lot of people come to open source from different areas. So let's go even further back. Like you were a student, you saw a value in this. What was probably the first thing that you saw? You're like, yeah, this makes a lot of sense. Can you go back there?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, like at the time, open source was not a growth hack or a distribution mechanism or an enterprise strategy. It was actually a movement, right? Yeah. It was grounded in a philosophical perspective, which was, if you go all the way back to the origins of the free software movement, it was like, software deserves to and demands to be free, and there should be open and equal access, as defined by specific Four Freedoms of the the free software movement. And so that resonated to me, right? Because there's something kind of like fundamental there before you get to all the business utility and all that kind of stuff. There's something kind of profound. And the combination of that along with just the mechanism that emerged in the late 90s with the advent of the internet and all these technology platforms that we had, but really like the human dynamics. It's like, you know, these days in 2024, everyone's talking about generative AI and the emergent phenomenon. It's like, it seems like it's alive. Like, you know, it's just a bunch of, trained weights, but it seems like it's human, right? So there's an emergent behavior these days, but like open source and free software is actually an emergent behavior of humans who gathered on the internet and started interacting in this way. So I just think it's fascinating. And there's something just fundamentally good and vital about it. And so, you know, again, I've had the fortune over the last, 20 years and more of being able to apply my energy towards cultivating that, investing in it, amplifying it, and trying to see how can we take that fundamentally good thing and amplify it and make more out of it and enrich it.
So now I'm going to ask you, you're talking about Stallman, you know, way back when, basically, I'm assuming that, you know, part of the, FOSS and everything. So how do you feel about companies making money off of open source?
I love companies making money off of open source. So I think this is, so again, like to my theory of the case is that there's this emergent behavior that happened, you know, in the late 90s and, you know, this continues. I mean, it's amplified many orders of magnitude more if you look at the level of open source participation on platforms like GitHub, et cetera, right? But ultimately, we need to support this. Like, we can't just count on this happening, by itself forever. And certainly as our organizations, our businesses, our governments, our civilization has become more and more dependent on this corpus of open source projects that arose kind of organically through this method. We can't, that won't work forever to just kind of like take it on faith and hope for the best that it's all going to meet the standards that we need it to meet, that all of these individual constituent projects, each of which is important to so many downstream use cases, is going to get the level of ongoing, you know, maintenance and support and so on. And so I think building businesses around open source is essential to creating the ability to reinvest in these things and to amplify them and to sustain open source. So I'm all about building businesses. You asked about my career. Early in my career, I had the benefit to be part of the early team at Red Hat that worked on the developed and brought to market the Red Hat Enterprise Linux business model, sort of seminal business model in open source software. I had the privilege of being the product manager for the first several releases of Red Hat Enterprise Linux and an executive at Red Hat then, working on a number of initiatives. And then my personal journey, I spent 10 years as an investor focused essentially solely on open source companies, funding and serving on the board and helping to steer and to develop companies working, again, or following the same principle of, you know, find an engaged community of organic open source collaborators. And then how can we build a business that amplifies it, which is really different from the more cynical kind of business open source view, I think, that is sometimes taken, which is like, hey, how can we monetize this? How can we extract value from it? My perspective has always been, how can we create more value? And then there'll be plenty to go around. It's sort of like a positive feedback loop.
No, that total agreement here, and I've seen it for many years. Tell me, so, Red Hat, I think that was the first $1 billion revenue open source company, if I remember correctly, and say that's like, oh boy, at this point, like 14, 13 years ago. So I've got to think that it was interesting if you were an investor in smaller startups, you know, like what were you looking for then? What type of things? Because the model was just being proven again by Red Hat and you know, I'd assume by Canonical and companies like that too at that point, but not necessarily I don't think that there was probably a full pathway that somebody who's just starting an open source or an open core or something like that business would see, oh yeah, that's exactly, you know, where I can project myself in next number of years. So as an investor, what were you doing back then, and how are you seeing things?
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, I think the most powerful and durable open source technology communities are those ones that start actually not with a business intent from the get-go, but start right. with an interest, a solution building, a passion kind of intent at the core. So that's always been what I've looked for in the, including in the businesses where I've, personally invested, where I've, been involved in the company, is like, where is there that like spark and early momentum? And then, so many times it comes to pass that there's a complementary business model that can be attached to that, that, again, provides a way to expand maybe that like passion-based community, to fund that community to work on some of the more boring business-oriented kind of hygiene process kinds of refinements to the core open source project that are important to organizations, downstream users who want to use that technology. And that's good news, because that means that's like fuel that can be go back into the creative process and can just literally fund the work of the developers who are working on those projects. And that's really the same analysis, the same theory of the case that has led to what we're doing with Tidelift.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, next step, you're a co-founder of Tidelift. What were you folks thinking, there? Like, what was the impetus? What was the impetus there? And then I want to contrast, maybe there's a contrast, maybe there's not, to where you are now. So when did you guys start Tidelift?
So we started in 2017, and we've been on the same course, following the same strategy and pursuing the same goal from inception. And okay. I'm happy to say we've found a lot of progress, and we've made a lot of we've grown a lot with this model. And to your question around like what's the original idea? Yep. Well, our original observation was that there is this model of building a company corresponding to an open source project, right? There's lots of examples of this. You might sure. say that, I think there's some nuance to the Red Hat example, because it's really a distribution of projects, hundreds of projects that are a composite product there. Mm-hmm. But, you have like sole product companies where there's like the open source project, there's the company that goes with it. I won't rattle them all off.
Right.
So that covers some portion of the open source project universe that's like, popularly used and importantly commercially applied. But it doesn't cover a huge portion of the open source project universe that's like very, very essential critical infrastructure for organizations that are building any modern software today. And typically the part of the stack that is not well covered is the application building blocks, all these JavaScript packages, Java mm-hmm. packages, Python packages,
right.
the so-called dependencies. Everybody knows that XKCD cartoon with the
we'll flash it up. I was just going to mention it. The developer in Nebraska, yeah, that holds exactly. up the internet.
so if you wander into any organization building and using software at scale, including all of the Finos member organizations, you'll find there's on the order of 10,000 packages like that, that are not coming from Red Hat, and they're not coming right. from any one of those startups, whether it's a public company or a venture capital backed startup. The vast majority of the software at that tier is coming from individual human maintainers. Now, it's not like these folks are starving to death. In most cases, they have a day job, they do something else. Many of them they might be a graduate student, or maybe they have a job in the software industry outside of the software industry. But the thing that is generally true for the vast majority of these projects, even the ones that are relied on by the financial service industry, other industries, is that the folks who are maintaining those, and very often the creators of those packages, they're not receiving an income. It is not their job to do that thing. They have a job doing something else, but they do this thing. And for that reason, that the activity that they are able to dedicate to those packages varies substantially, right? And some folks are in a privileged position where they can dedicate a lot of time and energy to very actively maintaining and securing their open source projects. Other folks, you know, have to balance their time. They have to balance their energy, and you know, they don't have the luxury to spend huge amounts of time. So the idea that we had with Tidelift is like, hey, how could we take some of the things that have worked, draw inspiration from some of the things that have worked, like Red Hat building a composite a product offering that pulls in many of these upstream packages, mm-hmm. and sort of like adapt that model to fit this space. So what the application development community, which is really who we're servicing here, they're not looking for like a long-term supported stable release, right. of all of these packages. And it kind of doesn't work because the variety and the scale of it is just too immense to do that. But they are looking for those packages to follow secure software development practices. Mm-hmm. They want them to be actively maintained. If they're not going to be actively maintained, they at least want to know, like, what's the end of life for this? Fundamental, right. things that you would demand of any software company that was selling you a product. Organizations kind of start using open source, assuming that all of those things are going to be true as well, but they're just not going to be true. And you're not going to even have that visibility unless you have some kind of productive collaboration with the open source maintainer. So our very simple idea was, the software is coming from somewhere. There's, mm-hmm. humans out there somewhere. Maybe we can go to those humans and say, thank you for creating this project and putting it out there. We appreciate that, but we want to ask you to do more. And specifically, right. what we want to ask you to do is go through this checklist of secure development practices, et cetera, attest to it. And to encourage you to do that, and to recognize your work there, mm-hmm. acknowledging that it's kind of boring but important work, we'll pay you to do it. So it's basically, we built a platform for individual independent open source maintainers to go into business, earning an income, doing these things for the open source projects that they set into motion or have been maintaining.
Nice, because these individual maintainers have never been responsible for, blamed for anything that's ever bad that's ever happened in the world of the internet or payments or anything like that, right?
I wish that were true.
Yeah, I remember
a better world.
I remember reading. I was working on something. Oh, I'll never remember why I was reading the story about the Heartbleed bug, but I think the story is basically around two guys named Steve. Is that right? That they were the maintainers, and I think one was like more full time, and they kept getting more full time because nobody else was there to do anything, right? And they were burnt out. Does that sound familiar to any maintainers out there? They were burnt out. They were not being paid, and they had incredible demands upon them that people were demanding companies. You know, major, you know, Fortune 500 companies were demanding, why wasn't this done? Well, because it's Steve and Steve. And so, you know, I remember even like reading the years later, you know, how, you know, they just totally burned out. But I believe at least for that one, was that the one that, that they were kind of brought into the fold somewhere. Somebody ended up funding them, you know, and things got better. So, you know, but this is, I'm assuming that you see this all the time, and this is, you know, part of the reason for doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my recollection is, I believe we're at the 10-year anniversary now of the Heartbleed incident around
OpenSSL.
And there was a OpenSSL Foundation put together, and there was some funding there.
That's
although
right.
I believe the funding tailed off fairly quickly as it receded into memory. But
right.
you know, the reality is that's one package. There's 10,000, 15,000 more of those, each of which can have a potentially, you know, extreme impact blast radius if there's the right kind of circumstances, right? Or the wrong kinds of circumstances.
Right.
And I think the the incident that's in the news over the last couple of weeks here as we record this around the XZ project is not just proving that point, but actually taking this hazard to a whole new level. Because here we have a circumstance where, you know, so many of the past large spectacle open source software supply chain disruptions have been, human errors or mistakes that were exploited by adversaries, right?
Right.
But now with this new XZ sequence of events, what happened is you had an independent open source maintainer of a critical but sort of under the radar open source package. And they were explicitly targeted because they were volunteers and struggling to keep up by a adversary. Most folks are saying this looks like a foreign state actor, given the level of sophistication, the duration of the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like the maintainer of XZ, if you look back at the original sequence of events, I think this goes back to 2021 when the adversary started participating. The maintainer said, I haven't lost interest in the project, but my ability to care has been fairly limited. It's good to keep in mind that this is an unpaid hobby project. So this is the actual words of the maintainer at question here. And then you have the advance of the, you know, sort of sock puppet, the fake account joining.
And
the maintainer says, Jiatan may have a bigger role in the project in the future. He has been helping a lot off list and is practically a co-maintainer already. And then years go by and this thing unfolds. So this gets to the, you know, fundamental question, we think, which is like, if this stuff is going to be our critical infrastructure, we have to make sure that the folks behind this who have the ability to secure these projects and to maintain these projects well, we have to make sure we meet them halfway and provide reasonable incentives. And it's easy to do, to justify doing, because there's extreme business impact and organizational impact if we don't partner with our suppliers here, as we do in every other supply chain known to humanity. we need to have a constructive partnership.
But that one's free. That we can just use that one saves us money, right? So you talk about 10,000 packages. I was also going to mention, what's the definition of a CVE and how many of those actually happen a day? If you have 10,000 packages, how many what is a CVE?
Critical vulnerability and exposures, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And then with that, I have looked before because I was doing research for a company a while back, and I was looking at, they're like, hey, take a look at this CVE. And I'm like, okay, I'll figure out what a CVE is and everything. And then I started going through, I'm like, wow, that's a lot every single day. What is going on here? And then there are lists that are published every single day of vulnerabilities that are found. So I can't even imagine as a maintainer and a distress maintainer, dealing with that. So that's interesting how you're approaching it to like take care of them, I'm assuming.
Yeah. And just to build on your point there, when you talk about open source software security or open source software supply chain security,
right.
A lot of the, very broad set of issues here to go tackle. Where the industry started this journey was, let us go identify the known bad releases that have already been, we've already found the defects in it that are critical, and go, address those, migrate to newer versions, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, by the way, a very good idea. Like, we often relate this to the, there's a culinary analogy here, right? So it's like, you should not eat spoiled food. Eating toxic food is a bad idea. You should definitely try to avoid eating, known spoiled food
that's been sitting out on the
sidewalk, right? So I'm not going to argue that you shouldn't do that. However, there's a much higher standard that you can seek out, right?
Yeah.
Which is, in the food analogy, you want to eat like high quality food, right? You want to eat ideally like Whole grain food, not junk food. You want to eat maybe, like, if you really want to go for it, farm to table, organic certified
clean
food, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
the reason why you want to do that is because your standard for your own human health is not getting poisoned. It's you want to be thriving, and you want to, you know, be building health and resilience in your body and your family to basically to really thrive and excel, right? And so we think that there's a very clear analogy. I believe there's a very clear analogy to our software supply chain as well. I mean, after all, it's basically the food, the ingredients of our software and our applications.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get the best outcomes if we aim higher than not toxic to well secured, actively maintained. And many of these questions are not just about things that have happened in the past, which is where this sort of CVE security vulnerability framing of the problem has to focus, because it's only based on a list of known defects.
Right.
We're trying to offer models and approaches to work with the maintainers we've been talking about in this conversation so far to get after this goal of, hey, let's identify open source projects and releases of those projects that have been vetted to be good, not just not bad, and where we have incentive in place to continue to have those projects well supported, and we know who's supporting them, and there's a defined security response process in place for things that may come in the future. So it's all about advancing beyond the reactive approach of avoiding toxicity, which again is a good idea to do as a starting point, to the next level of, hey, how can we actually build proactive health and resilience into the software that we use? And again, the really cool finding that we've found in building Tidelift to date is that this is a situation where everybody can win, right? The organizations that need the software to meet these standards need this kind of visibility. It's important to their business outcomes to know this and to do this. So it's worth them paying for it. And the open source maintainers who can make it happen, it's valuable for them to derive an income from their work getting after these, you know, enterprise assurances, business assurances for the software that they otherwise are doing as a hobby or a best efforts practice.
I want to kind of add to your analogy then. I do another podcast with a buddy of mine and it's about mind and body type stuff. And something that we talk about every once in a while is that it costs more to eat clean than it does to eat crap, right? Yep. And, but the cleaner you eat, the less crap that you eat, the less spoiled food you eat, the better your health is. And the better your health is, the better it is for the entire ecosystem, because, you know, there's less strain on insurance, there's less health insurance, there's less strain on hospital systems, there's less strain on, you know, it's the kind of the idea of what is it? I read a book recently that it was basically talking about the difference between sick care and health care.
Yep.
And sick care is just dealing with the problems, you know, like you're saying, but health care really should be about, you know, eating clean, being preventative, making sure that you're doing the right things in order to, you know, not only maintain things for you, but then again, it affects everybody else. And so adding on to the analogy, it just seems to make sense that, it's better for everybody. The fact that you do have something that is not rancid, whether it be software or food, but that does take time, energy, and money. And so that seems like, you know, again, where the basis of your company is. Not only admirable, but, you know, and this isn't like, I told you, this isn't an ad for, it's like, I get it. And coming from open source, like, it makes a lot of sense to me, because we do advocate, you know, for banks to have full-time employees that are working on open source projects, whether it's FinOS open source projects or any open source projects. But, sure. But you know, back to, yeah, there are so many packages that these banks use that, you know, they healthcare, I mean, every other, you know, company that's out there is starting to find out, like, hey, we should probably either help maintain ourselves, right? Put the time and energy and money into it, or you know, we kind of need to take care of the people that are, you know, taking care of us. So anyway, yeah. I think that's great, admirable, but also, you know, like, it's smart.
Yeah, I agree. And the public health analogy is a sort of an extension of that mm-hmm. food analogy, but it's very on point. I mean, one of the things that we, the activities that we engage in at Tidelift, one of the things we do is we convene a community online event every year with the goal of basically yep. intersecting organizations like Finos member companies who rely on open source creators with those like the literal actually humans, right? The maintainers that we work with. And so the event is actually called Upstream. And the reason why it's called that is because it has a dual meaning. So one is Upstream is a term of art in open source software communities. It's the like independent developers who, you know, kind of create work on the project. It's the source of the raw material project, if you will, that gets frequently incorporated into commercial products or offerings. So it's sort of the folks upstream from you. But there's also this, you know, kind of public health use of the terminology upstream. And one of the ways that I've heard it verbalized, and we shared it at the first time we held the Upstream conference, was there's a parable of a you know, two people on the side of a river, literally a stream, right? And they see a kid floating down in the river, kind of struggling. One of them jumps in, grabs the kid, drags him to the shore. Two more kids come floating down the river, you know, struggling, jump in, grab them both, bring them back to the shore. Three more kids come floating down the river. The other companion takes off, starts heading off. And the guy in the river says, "Where are you going? Like, we got to help save all these kids here that are struggling, floating down the river. Where are you going?" And his companion says, "I'm going upstream to figure out who's throwing all these kids in the river, right? Let's solve the problem at its source rather than constantly, you right. know, playing whack-a-mole." So, you know, and that analogy, that parable, you know, it applies as much to people, you know, buying high blood pressure medicine to, yep. you know, that's like the equivalent of pulling people out of the river versus, you know, some of the lifestyle interventions that can be taken, you know, further upstream. It also right. applies to organizations that are like, "Hey, my security scanner is going off because there's all these vulnerabilities in my open source packages." Well, maybe we can, you know, kind of tackle that by being a little bit more proactive and finding a way to partner with the open source creators that we have decided and opted into relying on. Let's find a partnership that's going to work there. That's what we're about at Tidelift. And I'm excited that, you know, one of the reasons why we've gotten involved in Finos is I think it's the same spirit. You know, in the context of the financial services industry and fintech companies, similar spirit of, hey, let's work together to, you know, get after some of the, you know, fundamental challenges that organizations face when they are availing themselves of this amazing abundance of, you know, creativity and technology. But like, we can't do it blindly. We have to also be practical and come up with ways that we can partner to make sure that this resource that we're relying on and depending on is well cared for and maintained, and we continue to reinvest in it. So really excited to be a new member of Finos and partnering with y'all and your member companies.
Yeah, no, and us with you as well. And I was, you know, you folks joined, I think we did the announcement on March 7th of this year. So, but I did want to read your quote because, you know, like I read a lot of quotes being in marketing and PR, but I did want to read it because one, I thought it was good, but it kind of not really caps our conversation, but it definitely, I kind of wanted you to expand on it as far as being involved with Finos. But the quote is, "Tidelift is thrilled to be partnering with Finos on its important work accelerating innovation in financial services through open source. Tidelift's unique approach of paying open source maintainers to ensure their projects flow or follow secure software development practices and contractually committing to these continue those practices into the future has made a huge impact in helping our financial services customers confidently make long-term investments in open source they use to power their applications." So
Could you expand on like why you started to go there, but why join Finos? Why, like, I know that there are a lot of bank members, but you know, what's the value for Tidelift in working with Finos?
Yeah, so I mean, first of all, you know, a number of our customers are Finos members, and so you know, we're meeting them in their community, and we have a number of great, you know, lead users and customers and partners that we've had in building and advancing this model. So for one thing, we're just trying to, you know, spread that that adoption and awareness to their peer organizations. So that's a useful thing to do. The other thing is, again, like, you know, there's a common dependency here of, you know, technology, software-powered companies in the large, but specifically the leading-edge financial services and fintech companies on the general corpus of open source projects. But also there are some specialized projects that are more important to financial services than to the average industry. And so there's an opportunity, we believe, for us to work together, you know, as part of the Finos group, to identify those and to specifically make a directed investment in reinforcing those open source projects that are depended on by this industry. And, you know, along the way, it's gonna encompass a lot of the underlying more fundamental open source projects that are relied on by all industries. And again, my point is, it's not just industry, it's not just businesses or organizations. I mean, it's society now is powered by software, and that software is 70 to 90% of it is this third-party open source that's coming from random people on the internet. Good time to get to know those random people on the internet and figure out how we can help make sure that that software meets the standards that we all need it and want it to meet. Organizations want to meet those standards. The creators they love spending their time and energy on ensuring that this software is robust, and they love working on these projects. I mean, that's why what got them started in the first place. But you know, sometimes the work is work. And so it makes sense for us to make sure that that folks can also derive a reward from that. And you know, beyond just, you know, bonus points kinds of things, there's an allocation of time and energy that is necessary once these projects get to scale. We need to make sure that we are funding that work that is going to be necessary to build open source software that we can depend on in the financial services industry and beyond.
Cool. Upstream is June 5th. From 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern, and for our friends across the pond, 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. British summer time. And I don't know about the West Coast, it's 3 hours behind, something like that. So anyway, how can people get involved with that? Is it in person, online?
It's online, so this is a global phenomenon, and as you mentioned, it will be live streamed on June 5th this year, and you can find out more by going to upstream.live, is the URL here. We're gonna have a great panel discussion, including some folks from the Finos team are gonna join us there, as well as some of the Finos representatives of some of the Finos member organizations as well.
Very
And
good.
you know, that discussion is gonna be about, it's really framed around like, what can other industries learn from the experiences in the financial services sector specifically? Obviously, a leading industry in terms of the application of technology, open source technology. So running into many of the challenges that other industries are going to face early, we're trying to surface those learnings, and also some of the consequences of being a regulated industry and some of the new requirements that that Finos and its member companies are you know involved in. So
Cool.
it should be a good discussion. We're looking forward to it.
Very good. So are we. So is Gab too. Will I see you in London or New York this year for OSFF?
We'll be around. We'll be exhibiting at in New York is our expectation, and we'll be on the scene in London as well.
Sounds great. Waiting to meet you in person, and if not, I'll just head up to Boston and go. I'll park my car somewhere. Yeah.
Plenty of places to park your car up here.
Yeah, very true.
I grew up in New York.
All right. Donald Fisher, CEO and co-founder of Tidelift. Thank you so much for your time today and really appreciate it.
Appreciate being a part of this, and thanks for the time to chat today, and thanks for a fun conversation.
Thank you.